Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Friday, December 12, 2025. I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli. We have a very eclectic set of stories in today's paper, so let's get to it. The featured photo on today's cover page is of a very large table with a large number of people sitting around it with several video monitors in the room. The caption reads, "Delegates from European countries attend an informal meeting of European Union Ministers of European Affairs on December 11th in Lviv, Ukraine." The lead story is from Reuters and is titled, "EU Seeks Long-Term Freeze of Russian Assets. Bloc is planning to provide loan to assist Ukraine," by Jan Strapesky. European Union governments want to agree on December 12th to freeze Russian central bank assets immobilized in Europe for as long as necessary, replacing the need for a vote to renew the freeze every 6 months, EU diplomats said. The move is the basis for the EU's plan to use the Russian sovereign assets in the EU for a loan to Ukraine that would keep it financed in 2026 and 2027, allowing the country to continue to defend itself against Russia's invasion. The European Commission has proposed using a provision of the EU Treaty, Article 122, to keep the assets frozen indefinitely. The provision gives EU governments a free hand to adopt whatever measures they see necessary by qualified majority to address a difficult economic situation in the EU. One EU diplomat said the plan was for ambassadors from the bloc's member states to agree on launching a written procedure to approve the use of Article 122 of the EU Treaty by tomorrow. The European Commission said last week that using this legal option was justified in the case of the Ukraine loan, to preserve the stability of the economy affected by Russia's war in Ukraine and the hybrid warfare of Russia against EU countries. The EU economic situation could further be destabilized if the security context was to further deteriorate as a result of Russia's intervention in Ukraine or in the member states, the Commission said, arguing that if Ukraine ran out of money and could no longer defend itself, the EU's economic situation would become much worse still. An agreement to freeze the Russian assets indefinitely would eliminate a key risk to the plan of using them to finance Ukraine because Moscow-friendly Hungary and Slovakia would no longer have the power to veto an extension of the freeze every 6 months as they do now. While the freeze of assets would be reviewed annually, the money would stay immobilized until there was no longer an immediate threat to the economic interests of the Union. Belgium, which holds $217.4 billion of the total $246.8 billion of Russian sovereign assets frozen in Europe, has been skeptical of the loan reparations plan. One of its worries has been that it would have to refund Moscow if the sanctions were lifted and the money had already been loaned to Ukraine. However, Belgium is worried Russia could launch successful legal action against it for the return of the money. To address that, EU governments are preparing guarantees for Belgium, under which they would step in to cover their share of the bill in the event of any financial repercussions. Russia has warned the EU and Belgium against using its assets, which it said would be an act of theft. The Commission says the plan does not amount to confiscation as the money would be in the form of a loan, although Ukraine would only have to redeem it if Russia pays reparations. EU leaders will discuss the reparations loan at a summit on December 18th, expect to make a decision on how to finance Ukraine over the next 2 years. Russia questions soldiers' actions. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said on December 11th that Britain needed to disclose what a British soldier killed in Ukraine on December 9th was really doing there, according to London, of helping Kyiv carry out acts of terrorism. Britain's Ministry of Defense said December 9th that the soldier, Lance Corporal George Hooley, died in Ukraine while observing Ukraine forces testing a new defensive capability away from the front line. Britain, as a leading nation in the so-called Coalition of the Willing, has repeatedly said it backs sending a multinational force into Ukraine after a ceasefire or peace deal is agreed, a potential deployment Russia has warned against. "London must honestly admit what their very own Hooley was doing there," Zakharova said. "It seems that perhaps someone there in Britain needs to carefully prepare public opinion in their country for military losses in Ukraine that would be impossible to hide and simply continue to conceal. She said that the British government should not deceive its citizens by claiming British soldiers sent to Ukraine were mere advisors or instructors, accusing British forces of helping Kyiv carry out terrorist and extremist attacks on London's direct orders. Zakharova, who said Russia would regard any foreign military contingents in Ukraine as legitimate targets, did not set out evidence to back up her accusations of alleged wider UK involvement. The British government, one of Ukraine's staunchest supporters, has never confirmed how many service personnel are in Ukraine, but the BBC has reported that a small contingent is supporting Ukrainian forces and is providing security to diplomatic staff. Ukraine hits Russian oil rig. Ukrainian aerial drones struck a Russian oil platform in the Caspian Sea for the first time on December 11th, halting production at the facility owned by Lukoil, according to an official from Ukraine's security service. The attack on the Filonovsky rig, part of Russia's largest Caspian oil field, is the latest sign that Ukraine is trying to step up its campaign to disrupt Russian oil and gas output. At least four drone strikes hit the platform, forcing extraction to stop at more than 20 oil and gas wells, the official said. The Filonovsky field, discovered in 2005, was inaugurated by Russian President Vladimir Putin in 2016 and produces about 120,000 barrels per day. Lukoil did not immediately respond to a request for comment about the attack. It was unclear where the Ukrainian military launched the attack from, but the Caspian Sea is more than 435 miles from Ukraine's nearest border. Ukraine widened its campaign in November by targeting unregulated tankers transporting Russian oil through the Black Sea. Three such vessels have been hit by Ukrainian sea drones in the last 2 weeks. The next two articles take us back to Arizona. The first one is titled, Arizona Upholds Hepatitis B Vaccine Guidance. Health officials tell providers to ignore feds, by Stephanie Inez. Arizona health officials told the state's health providers December 10th that the state continues to recommend the Hep B vaccine for all newborns, even though a once influential federal panel has advised otherwise. The Arizona guidance came during a joint webinar hosted by the State Health Department and the Maricopa County Department of Public Health that was held to provide clarity following a December 5th vote by the Federal Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, known as ACIP. ACIP historically has been influential on vaccine policy for the U.S., but since Robert F. Kennedy Jr. became the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and replaced most members of the committee, it has been criticized as a platform for vaccine skeptics and flawed science about immunizations. The committee on December 5th voted 8-3 that women who test negative for the hepatitis B virus should consult with their health care provider to decide when or whether their child should be vaccinated against the virus. The committee does not have regulatory authority, but states often consider the panel's recommendation when requiring vaccines for school-aged children and other groups. For parents who decline the birth dose, ACIP recommended the first shot be delayed to no earlier than 2 months of age. The committee did not change the recommendation that the newborns born to women who test positive or who have unknown status be immunized against the highly infectious viral infection. Jim O'Neill, who is interim director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has not yet signed off on the panel's Hep B recommendation. But medical organizations, sites, cities, regional health alliances, and some states, including Arizona, have been quick to respond with their own guidance to ignore what ACIP says about the Hep B vaccine. And that advice to disregard the ACIP vote is likely to stick, at least as far as the state of Arizona is concerned. Magda Rodriguez, a spokesperson for the Arizona Department of Health Services, on December 10th wrote in an email to the Arizona Republic that the adoption of the ACIP recommendations by the CDC director as they are currently proposed would not shift our recommendation. The Arizona Department of Health Services continues to recommend the hepatitis B vaccine within 24 hours of birth at 2 month and six-month visits, department officials wrote in a December 9th letter to Arizona health providers. This recommendation aligns with the current recommendations of the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Academy of Family Physicians and is supported by evidence-based practice, the letter stated. Hepatitis B has historically been the leading cause of liver cancer worldwide. Dr. Joel Terriquez, Medical Director of the Bureau of Infectious Disease Services and the Bureau of Immunization Services for the Arizona Department of Health Services, told providers December 10th. Perinatal and early postnatal transmission of hepatitis B are major causes of chronic hepatitis B infection, Terriquez told providers, emphasizing that public health officials always promote having parental consent as part of the process. That first dose of vaccine should be given as soon as possible after birth. It is important that state and county health departments in Arizona make it clear to birthing centers and hospitals that they are still recommending universal hepatitis B vaccines for all newborns so that Roque charge nurses and others don't misinterpret and make their own rules, said Will Humble, executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association. Hospitals can decide to go their own way. They could decide to listen to ACIP, Humble said. The way the state and county does this matters. It needs to be an all-points bulletin. Since the U.S. recommended a universal hepatitis B birth dose 34 years ago, infections in children and adolescents have fallen by about 99%, preventing tens of thousands of cases of liver disease and death, health officials say. The Arizona Department of Health Services on December 4th, one day before the ACIP vote, issued a statement reminding parents and healthcare providers of the long-standing evidence-based practice of administering the hepatitis B vaccine to newborns within 24 hours of birth. Parents are encouraged to discuss any questions with their healthcare providers. The universal hepatitis B birth dose is one of the simplest, safest, most powerful ways to prevent Arizona babies from a liver infection that is completely preventable. The complications of infection can be devastating and last a lifetime, the statement says. National leaders push back on federal vaccine skepticism. Senator Bill Cassidy, a physician and Republican from Louisiana, in a December 5th post on social media platform X, urged O'Neill not to sign ACIP's new recommendations. The American Medical Association immediately announced the ACIP vote as reckless and said it undermines decades of public confidence in a proven life-saving vaccine. Kennedy's mixed messaging on vaccines in September led California Governor Gavin Newsom, Oregon Governor Tina Kotek, and Washington Governor Rob Ferguson to launch a new West Coast Health Alliance, which has since issued its own vaccine guidance to provide more clarity to the public. The alliance aims to ensure residents remain protected by science, not politics, and a unified regional response to the Trump administration's destruction of the U.S. CDC's credibility and scientific integrity, according to a September 3rd news release from Newsom's office. Hawaii has since joined the alliance, too. Other regional health alliances, as well as the Governor's Alliance, have emerged to offer what they say is evidence-based public health guidance to counteract messaging coming from the federal government. So far, Arizona has not joined any of them. Reach healthcare reporter Stephanie Innes at stephanie.innes@gannett.com. Today's last front page article is titled, ASU's Hurley, Ex-Athletic Director Anderson Was Slow to Act on Harassment, by Miguel Torres. ASU men's basketball coach Bobby Hurley said he was shocked that former athletics director Ray Anderson didn't take immediate action after he was told a wealthy athletics donor had sexually harassed Hurley's wife. Hurley testified on the final day of a 7-day trial in a lawsuit brought by a former associate athletic director who contends he was fired in retaliation for reporting claims about harassment by the donor against several women. Hurley told jurors he thought Anderson downplayed the claims. They were reported to Anderson by David Cohen, the former associate athletic director and ticketing manager who is suing over his termination. The university argues that Cohen was fired for performance issues and insubordination in a trial that has led to high-profile university leaders, including President Michael Crow, taking the witness stand. At a basketball game in March 2019, Cohen was told by his then-wife, Kathy Cohen, that influential donor Bart Ware had touched her waist and her breasts. Other women, including Bobby Hurley's wife, Leslie Hurley, told Cohen they also had uncomfortable interactions with Ware. Cohen said in earlier testimony that Hurley's wife had told him that Ware was repeatedly inappropriate, but did not go into details of what happened. Leslie Hurley had asked Cohen not to say anything about the incidents until after the basketball season ended, Hurley said in court. They didn't want my mind clouded, and they knew that I would be very upset when I heard about it, he said. Cohen told Hurley about 10 days later and also informed Anderson. It was a very difficult conversation, Hurley said. Hurley told the jury he was frustrated when he learned in May 2019 no action had been taken. ASU launched an investigation months later in August 2019. Hurley testified that he called Anderson after Ware showed up at a basketball game in December of that year. Anderson downplayed the sexual harassment on a phone, Hurley said, calling it a 2 or 3 on a scale of 1 to 10. Anderson, who resigned as athletics director in 2023 and is now a professor at the university's law school, took the stand and disputed Hurley's version of the conversation. I said, when there are offenses, people rate it on various levels. It could be a 2, a 3, all the way up to a 10. Neither you nor I know what the investigation found in terms of the level of the allegation, Anderson said. He said he told Hurley that they would have to wait for the investigation to conclude before they could make any sexual harassment claims about Ware. He didn't like that answer, Anderson said. Job changes, new manager, led to claims of retaliation. Cohen's attorney, Jeffrey Feasby, claimed during closing arguments that Cohen did everything right and was ultimately fired for it. Feasby argued that Cohen followed the chain of command by reporting Ware's actions to Anderson, his direct supervisor, and the university leaders, including President Michael Crow and Chief Human Resource Officer Kevin Sausalito, agreed that reporting to Anderson was sufficient. Anderson has said he would talk with Ware and handle the situation according to Cohen's testimony. But after inaction from Anderson and the school, Cohen pushed the issue and Anderson became upset, Feasby said. Mr. Anderson didn't handle it. He never spoke with Bart Ware. Mr. Anderson himself testified that was a mistake. And he also testified that he never reported it to anyone, which was also a mistake, Feasby said. Those mistakes ultimately cost Cohen his job. Months later, Cohen said his duties changed. He lost oversight of the swimming and diving programs and was assigned to a new manager. Cohen asked Anderson at an August 2019 meeting if these changes were connected to reporting Ware. Anderson denied it and became infuriated, Cohen testified. Mr. Anderson had no intention of speaking with Mr. Ware, and he was only interested in Mr. Ware's money, Feasby told the jury. Anderson testified that he fired Cohen days later. Cohen was actually placed on leave, however, and officially terminated in December 2019. After the August meeting with Anderson, Cohen told a university human resources official about the sexual harassment claims, which launched the investigation. Cohen later filed suit against Anderson and the Arizona Board of Regents, which governs public universities in the state. Cohen claimed he was unable to find a job in the sports field since his termination, a problem he never had before ASU. ASU's investigation into the harassment allegations ultimately confirmed that sexual harassment incidents occurred, but that the investigation did not support a finding of retaliation in response to a report of that harassment. ASU said in a previous statement that the university canceled the donor's season tickets and informed him he was no longer welcome at university events, and he's otherwise dissociated himself from the university and related entities that support athletics. University's attorney focuses on relationship with ticket vendor. Robert McKergan, attorney for Anderson and the Arizona Board of Regents, presented the case in three simple questions during his closing arguments. Was what Cohen did when he reported the harassment to Anderson a legally protected act? Did Cohen face retaliation? And did Cohen face retaliation because of a legally protected action? McKergan claimed that Cohen was required to report the harassment to the Dean of Students Office, the Office of Equity and Inclusion, and the Title IX Coordinator, which protects all people involved with the university from sexual harassment or discrimination. When Cohen failed to report to any of those offices, he violated the school's policy and thus was not under Title IX protection, McKergan argued. McCartan argued Cohen was not fired in retaliation, but for other reasons, including what he described as Cohen's unsavory relationship with the ticket broker Vivid Seats, which buys discounted tickets from ASU and resells them. Cohen had received a $690,000 check from the company a few years prior to the harassment report and initially deposited it into his personal account, he testified. He said it was sent to him by mistake, and he returned the full amount a few months later. Records were presented to the jury to confirm the funds were returned. But McCurgan told jurors the timeline was inconsistent. Cohen deposited the check February 15, 2017, transferred it to an account for his private company, and later moved it to an investment account. He then, a few months later, for whatever reason, perhaps because ASU was investigating his relationship with Vivid Seats, sent the money back, he said. Cohen went through these transactions without ever telling ASU, McCurgan said. Why didn't he just rip up the check? Why didn't he just put it in his wallet and take it to the office? McCurgan asked the jury. He has no answer for any of these questions. ASU didn't know about the check until after Cohen was placed on leave, according to testimony. Earlier testimony focused on a June 2019 performance review in which Anderson said Cohen became upset over a reduced bonus. Anderson said he increased the bonus after Cohen pleaded his case, but removed swimming and diving duties so Cohen could focus on ticket sales. They also moved him to another manager in August 2019, McCurgan said. That move was not a demotion or a reprimand, McCurgan claimed. It couldn't be because the contract Cohen was under specifically said that Anderson could assign Cohen to report to anyone he chose. Cohen complained that the actions were done out of retaliation and that he expressed concern about working for a different manager, Anderson testified. Anderson said Cohen was insubordinate because he complained about being moved to a new manager. The issue for the jury is not whether Anderson fulfilled his duty to report. The issue is why Cohen was terminated, McCurgan said. If Cohen was retaliated against for the reporting, he would have been fired much earlier, and Anderson certainly wouldn't have given him an extra $25,000 during his bonus review months earlier, he said. David Cohen got fired because he was insubordinate on August 12th, he said. David Cohen had been given first, second, third, and fourth chances. Mr. Anderson had had enough. The case was sent to the jury to begin deliberations. You can listen to any of our programs on demand by going to our website. Go to sunsounds.org. Click the link labeled Broadcast, Info, and Audio. Then you'll see programming links with a link for on-demand programs. The first story on today's Valley and State page is titled, Scottsdale Will Close Two Elementaries. Budget Fears to See Pima, Echo Canyon Repurposed by Alexandra Hartle. Scottsdale Unified School District will be closing both Pima Elementary School and Echo Canyon Elementary School in anticipation of a budget shortfall the school board decided at its December 9th meeting. In a 3-2 vote, the board opted to shutter the schools and repurpose them, though it hasn't yet been decided what they will be used for. The vote came after the governing board last month discussed the possibility of closing the two schools. Board members Amy Carney and Corrine Werner, who is also a state senator, voted no. The two have been outspoken in opposition to closing the schools. After the public comments section of the meeting, they advocated for a board-appointed committee to increase transparency within the process and explore other options to save money. The other board members, Donna Lewis, Matthew Patinsky, and Mike Sharkey, all voted to repurpose the two schools. Patinsky attributed the need for the closures partly to changing demographics, which he said have been projected for years. The budget shortfall can also be attributed to state policy, with Arizona ranking 48th in terms of per-pupil funding, Patinsky said. At the same time, the state has created a $1 billion voucher entitlement program encouraging families to leave public schools rather than spend money to strengthen them, Patinsky said. Parents and community members expressed frustration during the comment portion of the meeting, saying the board didn't explore other options to save money. Superintendent Scott Menzel said after the meeting the district would start conversations with families at Pima and Echo Canyon to support them during the transition process. New boundaries will then be assigned to the district. District grapples with declining enrollment. Districts across the valley have had to shut schools or lay off staff in recent years due to declining enrollment. Most recently, Phoenix Union High School District voted to eliminate 167 positions because of a projected budget shortfall of about $20 million. According to Scottsdale Unified's website, Pima and Echo Canyon both currently have fewer than 300 students enrolled at the schools. According to documents from the November 18th Governing Board meeting, the district's demographic study found most of the single-family housing is being built in North Scottsdale. The multifamily housing that's being built in South Scottsdale, where Pima and Echo Canyon are located, is unlikely to attract families. On top of that, public schools are generally losing enrollment because of the rise of the now $1 billion ESA program. The district has seen enrollment decline of about 6,000 students since 2010, according to district documents. All that has resulted in the district experiencing a budget deficit of as high as $9 million during the 2026-27 fiscal year. The closure of the two schools will save the district about $2.5 million, according to district documents. The district will next evaluate a number of other elementary schools that have enrollments lower than 400. The caption says it all for the featured photo on today's Valley and State page. It reads, "People enjoy drinks at the bar during a soft opening of Durant's in Phoenix on December 9th. The next story is titled, "Market Features Native Art, Food, Live Entertainment on Tap for December 13-14 event" by Deborah Utizia Kroll. One of Phoenix's more intimate native art market kicks off December 13th with about 100 artists, live performances, hands-on crafts led by indigenous artists, and food. Lots of food. The 48th Annual Sedevaki Museum Indian Market on December 13th and 14th offers visitors a cozier venue than larger shows like the Heard Indian Fair and Market or the Santa Fe Indian Market. The market is held on the grounds of the Sedevaki Museum, which highlights the home and lifeways of one of the Salt River Valley's earliest peoples, the Hugam. The museum, once known as Pueblo Grande, was renamed in 2023 to more accurately reflect its origins as suggested by the Hugam's modern-day descendants, the Odom communities. The 100-acre museum was built around a 1,500-year-old Hugam village and the eponymous native art market that honors that homey vibe. Katie Shields, the market's chair, said the organizers of the Sedevaki Museum Foundation made the show easy to navigate for visitors, whether on foot, using a wheelchair, or pushing a stroller. A light rail station just outside Sedevaki's front gate provides a convenient way to access the museum and market, she said. Unlike other such venues, the Sedevaki Market brings in artist demonstrators to hold hands-on learning in beading, gourd art, weaving, pottery, hoop dancing, and other activities suitable for all ages in the Kikam village. There's even a special demonstration of the Atahi, she said. The ancient spear-throwing device will be wielded by an experienced practitioner. Also, world championship hoop dancer Tony Duncan, who is San Carlos Apache, Akira, and Hidata, will teach the basics of one of the Indian country's most popular sports, Shield said. Market isn't just about buying. In addition to Duncan, performances include the mellow strumming from Gabriel Aya, a classically trained Yaqui guitarist, dancer, and storyteller. Violet Duncan, a Kiwi Cree and Duncan's wife, traditional Akimi Odom dance and song group, G. Chino Spirit, and Gertie and the Teo Boys, who perform Waila, a swinging musical tradition unique to the Tohono O'odham tribe. "The market isn't just about buying," she said. "It's like going to a museum, but the people are right there." Not that Shields is discouraging people from opening their wallets, as many native artists depend on these annual venues for a significant part or all of their income. The museum will also be open and is included in the market admission. Two exhibits on tribal connections to the water are currently on display. Parched, the Art of Water in the Southwest, which explores the deep disparities of water use and access throughout the state of Arizona, and Suga Hutag, Rekindling Our Connection, which showcases Akima Odom's river people, long-standing relationship with water, and the intersection of politics of water rights and the celebration of traditional agricultural knowledge. While visiting with their favorite artists or meeting new ones, market visitors can also learn more about the Hugom through outdoor displays of traditional homes and the central platform mound after which the museum is named. Guests can also munch on fry bread and an assortment of vegan dishes from local native food vendors. And representatives from the Gila River Indian community owned Ramona Farms will be on hand to show how foods traditional in the Southwest like famed tipperary bean can be prepared. Local basket weaver and potters is year's featured artist. Basket weaver and potter August Wood, who has Navajo, Tohono O'odham, and Akima O'odham roots, is this year's featured artist. He first learned basket weaving, including processing natural plants, from Akina O'odham weaver Sally Antone. Wood also learned pottery arts using the traditional paddle and anvil technique from the Lake Pishba artist Ron Carlos of the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian community. Sitavaki Museum was one of the first places I demonstrated at, said Wood in a statement. Now I'm excited to come back and be the featured artist in this year's market. It's a great place for me to show visitors that there are people still making traditional O'odham basketry and pottery. Deborah Kroll reports on indigenous communities and the confluence of climate, culture, and commerce in Arizona and the Intermountain West. Reach Kroll at debra.krol@azcentral.com. This is Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Friday, December 12, 2025. I'm your son, Sounds of Arizona, volunteer broadcaster Joe Napoli. You can listen to Sun Sounds on our dedicated Sun Sounds app available for both Apple and Android phones, or tune in via third-party apps like TuneIn. Listeners can also use voice commands on smart home devices such as Alexa and Google Home, or apply for a free specialized radio that receives the Sun Sounds signal. For details, go to our website, sunsounds.org. We turn to a story titled, Man Charged in Valley Stabbings, New York City Murder Turns Down Plea Deal, by Perry Vandal. A man accused of murdering an escort in New York City before coming to Arizona, where authorities say he stabbed and tried to sexually assault multiple women, rejected a plea offer that would have significantly reduced the amount of time he potentially faced in prison. Raed Al-Mansouri, now 28, was arrested and booked into jail last year after being indicted on multiple felonies that include 2 counts of attempted first-degree murder, 2 counts of attempted sexual assault, and 2 counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Wearing an orange jumpsuit issued to inmates incarcerated within Maricopa County jails, Al-Mansouri sat next to his attorney, Dakota Johnson, during a December 5th settlement conference. He initially appeared to accept the terms of the plea agreement, which would have had him plead guilty to an attempted murder and attempted sexual assault charge. Man can face more than 150 years in prison if convicted. Al-Mansouri pleaded guilty to the attempted murder charge, but the proceedings ground to a halt when Al-Mansouri pleaded not guilty to attempted sexual assault. Johnson appeared to be caught off guard by Al-Mansouri's response and tried to clarify his client's intentions. We can't go forward, Johnson tells Al-Mansouri regarding the proceeding. I told you that. A brief pause passed before Johnson asked, what's the point of this? Al-Mansouri whispered something unintelligible to Johnson, who responded, we talked about this beforehand. So we're not doing the plea agreement. We're going to trial, Johnson said to Al-Mansouri in what appeared to be an attempt to see if he understood the plea deal was off the table if he refused to plead guilty to the agreed-upon charges. That's correct, Al-Mansouri replied before adding, I understand the plea. That's fine, Johnson said. Here's the thing. If that's the choice you're making, then that's the choice you're making, which you need to understand, then we're going to trial. Al-Mansouri appeared in court again on the morning of December 10th, where he reiterated his desire to reject the plea offer and go to trial. Had he accepted the plea offer, Al-Mansouri would have faced 9.5 to 12.5 years in prison for each count to be conserved consecutively for a total of 19 to 25 years. Maricopa County Prosecutor Kathleen Campbell noted that, by going to trial, Al-Mansouri faced at least 10.5 years and up to 151 years in prison if convicted. Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Joseph Kiefer advised Amansuri there was no guarantee prosecutors would offer him another plea deal, and in cases where prosecutors offer another deal, the following one is typically less favorable. Amansuri told Kiefer that he understood and wished to proceed to trial regardless. Johnson declined to comment further on the matter to the Arizona Republic after the hearing had adjourned. Amansuri accused of attacking two women, stealing a car. Phoenix police responded to a reported robbery on February 17, 2024, in the area of Glendale and 19th Avenues. Surprise Police Department Detective Jerry Goebel testified during a 2024 court hearing that a 22-year-old woman was sitting in her car when Amansuri demanded she let him into the vehicle. Goebel said Amansuri told police he planned to drive somewhere remote to kill and rape her as he found her attractive. The woman, who worked at a nearby Starbucks, used the headset she normally used to take to-go orders to alert her colleagues to the attempted carjacking and to call the police. Goebel said Amansuri stabbed the woman once in the neck and attempted to stab her in the head, but was unsuccessful and later fled on foot. Goebel said Amansuri was eating at McDonald's near Greenway and Reams Road in Surprise the next day when an 18-year-old woman working at the restaurant entered the bathroom. Documents report that video surveillance showed Amansuri following the woman into the bathroom where he banged on the woman's lock stall before crawling underneath the door. Goebel said Amansuri brandished a BB gun, which Goebel said looked like a real handgun, and pepper sprayed the woman before stabbing her at least three times in the neck after she screamed. Amansuri then fled south and stole a 2005 Toyota Camry near Saraville Avenue and Acoma Drive, according to police. He said the stolen Camry's license plate was scanned and pinged multiple times near Scottsdale Fashion Square Mall shortly before Scottsdale officers stopped Amansuri and arrested him. Goebel said the woman had to be airlifted to Banner Thunderbird Medical Center in Glendale, where she underwent surgery. Medical staff told police the woman was in critical condition because her jugular had been nicked. After the surgery, Goebel said the woman described Amansuri to him and said his eyes looked evil. The woman told Goebel she feared Amansuri was trying to rape her based on the location in which he cornered her. Arizona incidents followed fatal stabbing in New York City. Amansuri was also suspected in the February 2024 fatal assault of Denise Olias Antariba, 38, at a Manhattan hotel in Soho, according to the New York Times. Goebel said Amansuri described to him in detail how he tried to kill Olas Asariba after he felt she shorted him on time for paid sex and ripped him off. Goebel said Amansuri told he tried to break Olas Asariba's neck as he choked her, stomped on her head several times, and later put a sock over her head to suffocate her. Goebel said Amansuri described Olas Asariba's death as his first murder, and he didn't know whether the 18-year-old and 22-year-old he admitted to stabbing survived their injuries. Before the interview, Goebel said Amansuri spoke with other officers and said he figured they were looking for him based on the New York homicide. Amansuri told police he was in Arizona for roughly 10 days and decided to go to Surprise after stabbing the Phoenix woman. Goebel said Amansuri's motivation because his alleged crimes came from his failed attempts at finding someone who would love him, and that Amansuri described himself as being addicted to sex. New York, Arizona, prosecutors spar over extradition. Amansuri's case gathered national headlines after Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell announced she wouldn't extradite Amansuri back to New York and accused Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg of being soft on crime. Having observed the treatment of violent criminals in the New York area by the Manhattan DA, I think it's safer to keep him here and we'll keep him in custody so he cannot be out doing this to individuals in our state or county or anywhere else, Mitchell said during a news conference. Bragg's office lambasted Mitchell's announcement and asserted Amansuri's extradition wasn't a decision for her to make. Mitchell's behavior cheapens justice and does not center the victims. It's inappropriate, Bragg said at the time. I've done this for 20 years, and I've never seen anything like this. Bragg said he was willing to speak with Mitchell about the extradition at the time. It was not immediately clear whether that discussion took place. Amansuri's next scheduled court hearing was February 5, 2026, in Maricopa County Superior Court. His trial is expected to begin later that year. Reach reporter Perry Vandell at perry.vandell@arizonarepublic.com. We have a story by Stephanie Inez titled, Man Rescued Off Camelback Mountain. An adult male hiker was rescued on the morning of December 10th after spending the night on top of the Camel's Head of Camelback Mountain in Phoenix. A helicopter lifted several police and fire rescuers onto the mountain to assist the hiker, who was fitted with a harness and a hoist system and brought down to safety by helicopter, according to Phoenix fire officials. He is now in stable condition at a hospital. Fire Captain D.J. Lee described the rescue as a high-risk operation that lasted 13 hours and involved between 30 and 40 fire and police personnel. "I have not seen a rescue off the Camel's Head before, which is completely new for us," Lee said December 10th from a command center at the Echo Canyon Trailhead. "We do tons of rescues off the actual mountain itself, but this was a different location, something a little bit new." Lee said it's unclear which trail the hiker used to get to the top of Camelback Mountain, which is a popular hiking area known for its steep climb. One of the usual trails up the mountain, the Echo Canyon Trail, has been closed due to erosion since October from recent storms, but the other trail up the mountain, known as the Choya Trail, is open to hikers. Fire and police personnel set up a command center for the rescue at the Echo Canyon Trailhead overnight. A Phoenix Police Department helicopter first spotted the hiker waving his arms to indicate distress on the top of the mountain at about 8:15 p.m. on December 9th while doing patrols, but he was in such a difficult spot that fire officials had to wait until morning to rescue him. A drone was used overnight to bring the man a cell phone, water, food, and a blanket to stay in communication and warm throughout the nighttime hours, fire officials said. The man either did not have a cell phone with him when he got stuck, or his cell phone had died, and that initial lack of ability to communicate with him made the rescue difficult as well, Lee said. "We did periodic checks on him to make sure he was okay and see if he needed anything else," Lee said. "Once the sun came up, we were able to kind of reestablish our game plan to go in and extract him." Fire officials did not identify the man, nor provide other details about him. Broadcasts of the rescue showed the man wearing a light-colored shirt and dark pants. The Phoenix Police Department and the city's Parks and Recreation Department are handling an investigation into the incident. A police helicopter began lifting the rescuers into the Echo Canyon area, where the man was stuck about 8 a.m., according to officials at the scene. About an hour later, the man was off the mountain and brought into the parking lot area where he could be evaluated for any injuries. The man appeared to be talking with rescuers during the rescue broadcast. The Phoenix Police rescuers were visibly armed, but Lee described that as precautionary. Fire officials were unsure how the man got into his position on the Camel's Head. Lee said it's fortunate that the police department helicopter spotted the hiker during their regular patrols. "He's super lucky that the Phoenix police were able to spot him, because he could have been up there all night and nobody would have known," Lee said. Accidents and mistakes happen, but Lee said the incident is a reminder to be prepared when going on a hike. Never hike alone. Have a fully charged cell phone. That way, if something was to happen, you can activate 911, Lee said. Bring plenty of water and wear the appropriate clothing. Be prepared for the hike and be safe. We turn to another crime story titled "Officials Want Public's Help with Lake Havasu Cold Case" by Stephanie Innes. Authorities in Mojave County are asking the public to help them solve the mysterious case of a white adult male whose body was discovered 25 years ago in a cove near Lake Havasu City. Boaters found the man's severely decomposed body on October 7, 2000 in the cove, and his identity has been a puzzle ever since. The Associated Press reported on October 13, 2000, that the man was killed, but no other information was released about how. The Mojave County Sheriff's Office Special Investigations Unit is now asking the public to help them solve the case. The man was estimated to be between 20 and 40 years old and described as 5 feet 10 inches tall with a mustache and brown hair. He was wearing a t-shirt with a Hot Boat Magazine Performance Team logo on it. Officials said the man was also wearing a Casio calculator watch and carrying a utility knife and small flashlight with the letters JKP inscribed. Authorities estimated he had been dead for about a month before he was discovered. A sketch of the victim was completed in January 2001 by the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's Office and issued to the public with no success, but the Special Investigations Unit is hoping to identify the man and revitalize the investigation. Anyone with information useful to the investigation is encouraged to contact the Mojave County Special Investigations Unit at 928-753-0753, extension 4408, and reference DR number 00026283. We have a USA Today article titled, "Trump, Oil Tanker Seized for a Very Good Reason," by Seibel, Mays, Osterman, and Joey Garrison. The United States has seized an oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela amid a months-long buildup of military force surrounding the country, President Donald Trump confirmed December 10th. "As you probably know, we've just seized a tanker off the coast of Venezuela," Trump said at a meeting at the White House. "Largest one ever seized, actually, and other things are happening." Trump declined to provide additional details about the tanker to reporters and said the administration would be releasing more information at a later time. "You see the result, and I guess they are probably released the pictures by now pretty soon," Trump said. "You will discuss that with the appropriate people later on." The president added it was seized for a very good reason. The vessel was under U.S. sanctions, according to three people with knowledge of the matter. They said the cargo on board was owned by a businessman with ties to Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, and the boat was bound for Cuba, people said. The news was first reported by Bloomberg. It comes after the United States has built up military forces around Venezuela for months in a pressure campaign by the Trump administration to remove Maduro. U.S. Southern Command and the Pentagon referred USA Today to the White House for comment. Separately, the U.S. military has launched 22 strikes on boats in the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific Ocean, killing at least 87 people, including some Venezuelans. Critics have called the strikes, which have not been approved by Congress, illegal and say they amount to extrajudicial assassinations. Trump and his officials have said Maduro is the leader of a criminal enterprise called Cartel de los Soles. Experts have told USA Today that Cartel de los Soles is a loose network of corruption and not a real drug trafficking organization. Maduro and other top Venezuelan officials were indicted on drug trafficking and corruption charges in 2020. We turn to an article titled, "GOP Lawmaker Wants to Ban Fluoride from Drinking Water," by Ray Stern. An Arizona lawmaker's proposal to ban fluoride in the state's drinking water would defy decades of research and, according to dental experts, lead to more tooth decay among residents. The bill, filed before the state legislature begins its 2026 session by Senator Janae Schamp, a Republican from Surprise, would prohibit any person or government entity from adding fluoride into a public water system or any water that will be introduced into a public water system. "Adding fluoride to public water supplies amounts to mass medication of our population without informed consent or the ability to opt out," Schamp told the Republic in a text message. "Unlike voluntary measures like fluoride toothpaste or dental treatments, this forces every Arizonan, from infants to the elderly, to ingest a chemical they may not need or want." Regina Cobb, a former Republican state representative and the current executive director of the Arizona Dental Association, called the bill ridiculous. "Many studies show fluoride's benefits. Its prohibition in Calgary, Canada in 2011 resulted in increased levels of tooth decay," she said. The city of Calgary reintroduced fluoride to its water this year. "You think our AHCCCS bill is not going to go up? You're crazy, because it is," she said, referring to the state's health care system that's funded with state and federal money. "So now we're going to put all of our children at risk." Schamp's bill follows the implementation of similar bans in Utah and Florida in May. U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Robert F. Kennedy Jr. also called for an end to community water fluoridation and told Utah officials in April it makes no sense to have it in our water supply. Since being picked by Donald Trump to lead the country's health agency, Kennedy has been criticized by doctors and scientists over his medical conspiracy theories, including discredited links of Tylenol and vaccines to autism. Essentia fluoride came after a study showed the chemical at high levels could cause cognitive decline in children, and he directed the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to review its effects. In the 2024 study by the National Toxicology Program, an agency affiliated with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, was based primarily on epidemiology studies in foreign countries such as Canada, China, India, Iran, Pakistan, and Mexico. A summary on the agency's website highlighted how the study wasn't able to determine if the level of fluoride recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which is 0.7 milligrams per liter, is harmful to a child's IQ. Because fluoride can be present in natural water sources and is toxic in high doses, the EPA sets a limit of 4 milligrams per liter in water supplies. An EPA review in 2015 resulted in the current standard for intentional water fluoridation meant to lower the rate of dental cavities, lowering the standard from 0.8 to 1.2 milligrams per liter that had been in place since 1962. This agency is thoroughly reviewing the NTP report and other latest gold standard science to support the EPA's expedited reconsideration of the current standard, the agency told the Arizona Republic after an inquiry to EPA spokesperson Michael Alpern. Champ, an operating nurse in her second term as a state senator, has made health care a legislative priority and is a Kennedy supporter, but her ideas sometimes run afoul of mainstream science. In 2023, she chaired the Arizona Senate's novel Coronavirus Southwestern Intergovernmental Committee, an event that brought unscientific information to the public. If fluoride's addition to water is supposed to protect public health, why not vaccine water? Why not add multivitamins to water, Champ said. If the policy goal is to prevent tooth decay, then offer proper dental services. Asked how municipal water supplies mix in chlorine, a toxic chemical that in low levels kills germs, Champ said that was off topic. The city of Phoenix has added fluoride to its water system since 1990, a practice that aligns with guidance from public health agencies, including the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Michael Gertzman, a spokesperson for the Phoenix Water Services Department, told the Republic in an email. Phoenix maintains fluoride levels at 0.7 parts per million, which is the optimal concentration recommended by the CDC. The city routinely tests its water supply to ensure compliance with all federal and state drinking water standards, he said. You can reach the reporter at rstern@arizonarepublic.com or 480-276-3237. Next, we have a USA Today article titled, Court Weighs Low IQ in Death Row Case. Man's Varying Scores Complicate Decision by Maureen Gropp. After the Supreme Court in 2002 said inmates who are intellectually disabled can't be executed, prosecutors largely stopped seeking a death penalty for defendants with clear developmental disabilities. The borderline cases remained. Judges often hear competing testimony from experts about whether a death row inmate has a severe enough intellectual disability to prevent execution, a threshold the High Court left up to the states to determine. The justices on December 10th dove back into the issue, debating how courts should access the results of multiple intelligence tests when making close calls. 144 people have had their death sentences vacated due to intellectual disabilities since 2002, according to the Death Penalty Information Center. Whether the High Court will now make raising a claim harder is a matter of life or death for Joseph Smith, an Alabama inmate on death row for a brutal murder in 1997. Smith's IQ scores have ranged from 72 to 78. Because IQ tests have an error range, lower courts said Smith's IQ could be below 70, one of the factors for defining intellectual disability. But the state argues because all five test scores are above 70, Smith can't prove he's disabled by a preponderance of the evidence. Nothing in the Eighth Amendment bars the sentence Joseph Smith received for murdering Dirk Van Dam nearly 30 years ago, Robert Overling, attorney for Alabama, told the justices. He didn't come close to providing an IQ of 70 or below. Smith was convicted of killing Van Dam, who received 35 blunt force injuries and wounds from a saw on his neck, shoulder, and back. The Justice Department backs Alabama, arguing some judges are confused about how to evaluate multiple IQ tests under Supreme Court rules for what counts as cruel and unusual punishment, which is prohibited by the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. About 10% of people on death row have claimed that an intellectual disability bars their execution. Roughly one-third of the claims have been successful, according to John Bloom, director of the Cornell Death Penalty Project at Cornell Law School. That's a significant success rate for claims raised by death row inmates, he said. Lawyers for Smith contend that multiple IQ scores must be assessed holistically, which includes testimony from experts about their validity. And when IQ scores alone are not conclusive, they told the court, defendants can offer additional evidence. Alabama law, like that of nearly all other states, requires courts to evaluate all probative evidence as to intellectual functioning offered by either side, said Seth Waxman, an attorney for Smith. That's what the lower courts did when finding Smith could not be executed, they argued. Federal judge called Smith a close case. U.S. District Judge Kelly V. S. Grande called the evaluation of Smith's mental functioning a close case, but wrote, the evidence indicates that Smith's intelligence and adaptive functioning have been deficient throughout his life. The Atlanta-based 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals agreed. The Supreme Court's 2002 decision that executing someone with an intellectual disability violates the Eighth Amendment left up to the states how to make that determination. But later decisions in 2014 and 2016 faulted Florida and Texas for how they evaluated the disability. The court said the states can't rely on a single IQ test and must take into account the possible error range in tests and must also consider other factors. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, one of the court's three liberal justices, said Alabama wants to change the standard to make it all about IQ tests. She emphasized that mental health organizations say intellectual functioning can't be evaluated solely by test scores. But Justice Samuel Alito, one of the court's staunch conservatives, suggests there be a greater consistency and predictability in death penalty cases if a defendant has to meet a concrete standard. It's not one of the lodestars of the court's death penalty jurisprudence as opposed to a situation where everything is up for grabs in every case, Alito asked Henry Graver, the attorney for the Justice Department. Graver said he 100% agreed. He also backed Justice Neil Gorsuch's suggestion that the court could clarify the states can't treat a single IQ score in the low 70s as decisive or use other factors to outweigh IQ scores. I agree there's some confusion, Gorsuch said, about the court's previous rulings. That's why we took the case. Justice Sonia Sotomayor disputed the courts don't know how to apply the past rulings. I don't see all that much disagreement, she said. We announced a new rule. We've announced more confusion into an area where there's pretty standard procedures. Oberling, the attorney for Alabama, said the justices can overrule the lower court in Smith's case simply because it didn't give enough weight to the cumulative effect of the IQ scores. We're going to have to wrap it here for Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for Friday, December 12, 2025. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli, thanking you for listening to Hour 1 and encouraging you to stay tuned for Hour 2 and our other great programs here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.